The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you, Jenna.
Good morning. Welcome to the last session of, not the rally, but the last workshop session of Socialism 18. This is the first time that we're offering this workshop at Socialism. We think it addresses a growing need in the left. We look forward to getting your feedback, how useful you found it, what you would change, what should be added, what wasn't that helpful. This workshop is for anyone who's a socialist at work, whether you're in a union or not. Quick survey of the room, how many folks here work in the public sector? Great, how many work in the private sector? Wow, okay. And how many are in a union? All right. And how many folks stayed up too late last night partying and wish you were still in bed? All right. So being a socialist at work, it's kind of a strange title. If you're a socialist and you don't own any means of production, then you're going to have to work for wages to pay your rent and your groceries. So by the very fact that you're a socialist and you're at work, you are a socialist at work. Of course, the title implies something a little more active. It implies activity. It suggests that you are an active, open socialist at work. So we're not talking about being in the existential sense. If you're looking for the being in socialism workshop, it's next door. That was my attempt at philosophical humor. But while we're on the subject of philosophy and Marxism and existentialism, we should remember that for most working people, work is a great source of alienation. As a system, capitalism promises people a happy and fulfilled life. The way to that happy life, to the American dream, is through work, so you can earn enough money to purchase that dream and to buy you some happiness. Now, the contradiction that Marx pointed out a long time ago is that for most people, most of the time, work under capitalism is frustrating and an unpleasant experience. We often experience the world of work as atomized individuals who are powerless, who have little say or control over how we use our labor and what we produce with that. And we can be alienated from our coworkers, who can be in competition. We can be in competition with them for jobs, work assignments, schedules, overtime, promotions, and so on. However, work in the workplace carries a special importance for socialists, revolutionary socialists. The Socialist Project is about the self-emancipation of the working class through struggle from below. For socialists, the working class is a potentially revolutionary force based on our social position. We are situated at the heart of modern capitalism, at the point of production where profits are created. And this gives workers a strategic position at the heart of the modern economy. To a large extent, we're already organized by our employers. We're brought together to work together in factories, warehouses, stores, offices, hospitals, and so on. And we're strategically placed in teams, work groups, departments, and divisions. But because we're brought together by the employers under circumstances that we do not control, we're often forced to struggle, be it for the security of our employment, the level of our wages, to control the pace or intensity of work, to asserting some dignity and demanding some respect in the job. And because we're exploited collectively, there's little to no room for us to fight that exploitation as individuals. The workplace is where we have to struggle collectively. So the workplace, in addition to being a great source of alienation, can also be a place where we start to experience our power and experience comradeship with our coworkers and start to overcome the alienation. If you attended Friday's plenary session on the Red State Teacher Rebellion, you heard every teacher on that panel speak eloquently to this point. So now on the surface, socialists in the workplace seems like they should be a perfect fit. I'm reminded of an old movement poster when I was growing up and first becoming a socialist and revolutionary, and it had a picture of someone kicking down a door, and it said, "Remember, while you're smashing the state, keep a song in your heart and a smile on your face." So work should be the place we go to with a smile on our face, a song in our heart, while we kick some capitalist butt. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. As socialists, when we're at work, we're faced with questions like, how do I get active? Is there a union? How do I get plugged in? To what extent? You can be the lone socialist at work. If you're fortunate enough to have a union, the union could be weak, it could be very bureaucratic, run from the top down. Often your coworkers might feel disaffected from the union. And even if you're in a union, You might be one of the few, if the only activist in the union. If you have a union, they might put up barriers to your getting involved, or the union might welcome you with open arms. They have so few stewards and activists, they're ecstatic to have someone that shows interest. The danger is that they're gonna suck you in and then suck you dry. But we also face questions like, how do I raise socialist politics? Am I an out socialist? If so, how out am I? Do I sell socialist worker or whatever organization you belong to, whatever your socialist press is? So even though we're socialist and we have this special affinity to work in the workplace, it can feel a little intimidating and confusing when you're starting out. So we can call this a special case of socialist alienation at work. So let's talk about how we overcome this alienation and keep that smile on our face and that song in our heart while we wage war against capital. So the next 90 minutes we're going to take a collective stab at answering these questions. We're going to share ideas, we're going to look at some best practices of socialists at work. I love that business lingo. Best practices of socialists at work. We're going to talk about our challenges, many of which are common to a lot of us, and some are unique based on our own circumstances. A warning up front, there are going to be no universal one-size-fits-all answers. A lot's going to depend on your very particular circumstances, where you work, your workplace dynamics, the work culture, is there a history of struggle or lack thereof, what's your boss's management style, are they the nice boss, or are they like from the Dilbert cartoon, the evil Catbert? At the end, we're going to look at some tricks and traps of being a socialist at work. I'll give you my top 12 to 15. In turn, I encourage you to share any tricks or traps that you've gleaned from your experience of being a socialist at work. So first, a big picture overview of what's involved in being a socialist at work. In the ISO, we define our socialist labor work as building our collective fights at the workplace, defending, extending, and strengthening trade unions, constructing and fighting labor left, and within that, building a revolutionary socialist current. Now, these are not individual or discrete things we do. They don't advance in some predetermined sequential order. Building strong trade unions, building the fighting labor left, and socialist organization for us are interconnected and simultaneous parts of building a fighting, conscious, revolutionary class in this country. Now, if you take a step back, what all these sort of buckets of work have in common at their root is about building political relationships with your coworkers. One of our chief battles today, I can't remember, someone said this at one of the teacher panels, one of our chief struggles today is really the question of ideas. How do we break the hold of the past? And we need to use conversations with our coworkers to make change, whether it's winning our coworkers to take collective action, forming a union, if you're in a union, in an open shop environment, convincing the non-union members to sign up, working with and collaborating with others on the left, and winning union militants to revolutionary socialism. If you're in the DSA, I see another comrade from Solidarity, you might define your socialist approach to trading work and labor a little bit differently. If so, you're welcome to share that with the group. So let's start with building and strengthening extending trade unions. One way to sum up the revolutionary socialist approach to trade unions is that while unions are necessary, they're not sufficient. Building strong, powerful unions is an important goal for revolutionary socialists. They're the basic defensive organization of the working class. Marx and Engels were the first socialists to understand this and champion trade unions. Under capitalism, individual workers have very limited power and limited wealth. A primary way that workers can gain more power over our lives is by uniting together into a union and utilizing our collective power and our collective wealth. Unions have risen in country after country across the globe in response to the rise and the expansion of capitalism. But there's another side to trade unions. On the one hand, unions unite us for our collective fights. On the other hand, trade unions divide workers and keep us separated. Could be on the basis of trade, occupation, employer, any number of things. Tony Clift makes the point that the geography of trade unions often matches the geography of capitalism. Another issue with trade unions is that they can derive their power from inclusion or exclusion. Some early unions built their power by limiting the labor market, and that meant they excluded blacks or women or immigrants or unskilled workers. Other unions have built their power through inclusion by uniting all workers. And as socialists, we understand that unions fight the effects, but not the causes of those effects. In other words, unions exist to improve the terms in which workers are exploited, but not to end that exploitation. There's another limit to trade unions. The generation after generation of working class militants have created powerful trade union organizations. Union militants have risked their lives and fought pitched battles to defeat the open shop. They've gone on to build strong trade union organizations, strong enough to wrest major concessions from capital, redistribute wealth down to workers, and win major social welfare legislation. But generation after generation of workers have seen these same unions wane in power and influence. And in country after country, we've seen these strong trade union organizations undermined, weakened, and sometimes destroyed. Kim Moody writes that even at the zenith of power of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, capital had already set in motion their plan, their long-term strategy, to weaken and possibly eliminate trade unions, and we see that playing out today. To put it very crudely, under capitalism, trade unions must be either tamed or destroyed. In this country, they were tamed to be destroyed. Rosa Luxemburg, the great Polish revolutionary socialist, likened trade union struggle to Sisyphus, the Greek mythological figure who was forced to roll this immense boulder up the hill, and only as he got to the hill, it would roll back down again. So that's why we say that trade union organization is necessary, but is also not sufficient. Another area of our labor work is building and influencing the labor left. The labor left has played a key, oftentimes instrumental role in building the labor movement. Leftist ideas and strategies that emphasize class politics, collective struggle, fights at the point of production, strong workplace organization, the use of militancy, strikes, and forging democratic unions have really been at the center of some of this country's biggest labor battles. From the International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, to the Socialist Party, to the Trotskyists, to the Workers' Party, the Communist Party, the history of working class struggle in this country and around the world is often contiguous and intertwined with the history of the left. That's why our goal as socialists can't simply be limited to rebuilding trade unions. We have to also build a dynamic fighting left wing of the trade union movement. In any revived labor movement, we're going to be competing with those that want to return to business unionism, although a militant business unionism. In a revived labor movement, there are going to be those who want to build the union movement by limiting the pool of labor, specifically immigrants. There are going to be those in a revitalized labor movement who are in favor of protectionist tariffs, who might be attracted to right-wing populism, who oppose marriage equality, and so on. We know that some very good militants in the Red State Teacher Rebellion supported Donald Trump, and probably some still do. It's not logically inconsistent to be a militant trade unionist and hold these sorts of views. And there are those in the labor movement today, and there will be those in a revived labor movement who are going to tell us our future is in a Democrat, who supports free trade, the use of military abroad to protect American business interests, who support a militarized police force in this country, and who find excuses not to raise wages and to slash pensions and cut health care. So in addition to building unions, socialists need to be part of rebuilding the vibrant left wing of the labor movement, where we champion building workers' power from the bottom up. We want to be part of a fighting left that takes up class issues, that builds real unity by engaging in deliberate acts of solidarity, and that fights for democracy in our union and builds international solidarity. So at the same time that we're fighting to defend and extend trade union organization, we also need to build a strong and large labor left around a pool of ideas. Ideas that can be instrumental, sometimes decisive, in our future fights. However, we know that resistance is simply not enough. To borrow from Naomi Klein's most recent book, simply resisting Trump and or the employers and or the Supreme Court and or the labor bureaucracy is not enough. We need a positive vision of what it is that we're fighting for. Our co-workers might join with us in resisting this multi-pronged attack on labor or defending their particular set of wages and benefits and working conditions, but many of our co-workers also want an aspirational vision of the kind of society that we're fighting for. And that's where socialist ideas and socialist organization comes in. At the root of capitalism is a system that places the accumulation of profits over human needs and aspirations. It's a system based on a few owning and controlling the means of production, thereby guaranteeing that we're going to live in a society that will always be undemocratic and riddled with income inequality. Premature deaths from starvation, war, unsafe drinking water, lack of access to health care, and climate change are not accidental byproducts. They can be cleaned up. They are the inevitable byproducts of a system that elevates accumulation of vast wealth for the few and misery and toil for the many. And we understand that negotiating and renegotiating the price of labor under capitalism will always have its limitations because we're not getting at the root of the problem, which is the exploitation of our labor power. So over the weekend, we've heard from participants and leaders of the Teachers' Rebellion about how the employers and the politicians deployed their media and their propaganda machines that denounced the strikes, painted teachers as selfish and uncaring for the kids that they teach. We see how the right wing, in conjunction with the employers, have deployed the courts all the way to the Supreme Court to weaken worker organizations. And we see how the legislative branch has taken up the call to bash public workers, attack private sector workers, starve the public sector while heaping lavish tax cuts for the corporations and the wealthy. So there is an organizational and political cohesion arrayed against us. That's why we need an organization on the worker side. We need an organization that's the repository of lessons from the past, so we can avoid repeating mistakes, and that we can study strategies and tactics that have won for workers in the past. We need our own press, a socialist press with its circulation based on networks of workers. We need an organization that promotes the history of workers' struggles and the history and ideas of the socialist movement. We need an organization where we get to pool our resources, our talents, and our experiences, and an organization that's defined by our common political outlook, which is revolutionary socialism. We need an organization of organized socialists to create leaders for the fights ahead and for the next steps in our labor work, from building and extending trade unions to building this vibrant labor left. So in the remaining time, I want to focus on how do we as socialists, how can we build collective fights at the workplace? This is an important cornerstone of what it means to be a socialist at work. And when you're first starting off doing labor work, whether it's in the union or unorganized, it can seem intimidating to feel like there's so much to learn. So I'm going to share sort of what I've learned along the way. I call them the tricks and traps of being a socialist at work. Number one, you got to be good at your job. To be effective, you got to have the respect of your coworkers. You don't have to be the best worker, but you need to be proficient and competent. I wasn't the best paramedic in the world, but I was a good paramedic, and my coworkers knew that. Two, keep your head down until you pass probation. Even with the union, you're still at will until you finish probation. The employer can fire you at will while you're at their will while you're on probation, and you'll have little recourse. Number three, you've always got to speak up against injustice, mistreatment, and oppression. This is the exception to the previous rule of keeping your head down while you're on probation. If you see someone being mistreated, abused, harassed, or bullied, you have to speak up, and if necessary, you have to intervene. You don't say, I'm going to let that pass until I pass probation. You can pass probation to find that you have no credibility because you stood aside and ignored some racist or sexist or homophobic behavior. In the end, all that any of us have is our reputation, and we have to protect that. I would add scabbing to the list of things you can never do, even if you're on probation. When I was a probie new hire garbage truck driver in Detroit, I was in the Teamsters Union, and the laborers, which were in a different union, went on a wildcat strike in the middle of my probation period over some incident at work. So when I and 20 other newly hired truck drivers showed up for a 5 a.m. shift, the laborers had a picket line, and my coworkers were very sort of scared about what does it mean we're not going to go in while we're on probation. So I came up with the idea. I said, why don't we all just sign this piece of paper, everyone here witnesses that we're all here ready to go to work, but it was not safe for us to cross this picket line, wink, wink. We were drinking coffee and eating donuts with the laborers. So everyone took my advice except for one of my fellow drivers, who just felt he had to cross that picket line and show the employer that he was willing to do anything to get to work that day. So as he opened the gate, a laborer's punch came out of nowhere, sent him to the ground. I couldn't resist. I had to say, see, I told you it was dangerous to cross the picket line. So our wounded fellow driver, he ended up passing probation, but he had great difficulty regaining the trust and respect of his co-workers and the laborers. Now my locals had a dozen strikes in the last 5 years, and we still debate whether we ask probationary workers to honor the picket line or we tell them to go across and pass probation. And we let the workers make that decision. But my advice, if you're a socialist and you're on probation, you find a way not to cross that line. Four, keep your nose clean after probation. Even if you pass probation, keep your nose, I should say even if, when you pass probation, keep your nose clean. Stepping up as a union activist and a socialist at work is going to put two targets on your back. If you give management any reason, by missing work, by being late, taking long breaks, not doing the work, they're going to take you out. And it's going to be hard to mobilize your coworkers to support you. 5, mapping your work site. This is a must. Socialists have to be map makers. Every socialist should map your work site, whether you're in a union shop or unorganized shop. If you plan on doing any organizing at all, you've got to understand your work site. What do I mean by mapping? I mean a physical, two-dimensional schematic that shows where folks are. It could be by desk, it could be by machine, it could be by department building. If you work in a large workplace, start with your immediate work area and then build out. So what are you mapping? Any number of things. With Janice and the imposition of the open shop, you might want to map where members are versus non-members so you can see where the pocket of non-members are. You're probably going to know where the leaders and activists are. You could be mapping your communication distribution network. It could be social networks, informal work groups. It could be your socialist worker readers. Basically, you want to know everything you can about your workplace, your employer, and if you have a union, your union. And you're going to rely upon this map over the years and continually build on it. 6, identify the leaders. An important part of mapping is identifying and getting to know who the leaders are. If you're in a union shop, you're going to want to know who the union stewards are, any other union positions like bargaining team, contract action team, executive board, officers, etc. Whether you're union or unorganized, you're also going to find out who are the social movement activists. It could be Mary and Tamika went to the last women's march. It could be Francis is active in Black Lives Matter. It could be Dana is always talking about climate justice, and Peter always sends me emails about single payer. We've got to remember that not all of our coworkers want to become a shop steward and be a sort of a jailhouse lawyer for their coworkers. Some union members, potentially our best contacts, are not active in the union per se, but they're active in some social, racial, or economic justice area of work that they don't even think of as union work. And we're going to have to engage with folks in political conversations to discover this. I always wear my union jacket to whatever rally I go to. My local is 55,000 people. Every demonstration I go to, people come up and say, hey, that's my union. And these are folks I've never seen before, right, who are not connected to the union. And I get their phone numbers and get their contacts and try to create a role for them inside of our union. 7, find out who the natural leaders are. When mapping, you want to pay particular attention to find out who are the natural leaders. So what is a natural leader? Anyone who's ever tried to organize anything at work or get people to take part in action, and you're trying to talk to someone and get them involved, and they say something like, well, have you talked to Joe? Or what does Dana think of this? What they're really saying is, what does Joe or Dana think of this? Do they support this? Every work group and every social group has opinion makers. Often they're not the loudest, they're not the most talkative, but they are the people that people listen to. So how do you know who a natural leader is? Anyone? Any ideas?
They have followers.
They have followers. Anything else? Yes?
They like to publicly drag management.
Yes and no. Some natural leaders are the best workers, and people look to them and go to them, you know, when they have problems. And sometimes they are not the most anti-management type folks. But if you do find those people, I found one. Her name was Lori Veselansky. Yes?
They're not afraid to speak up, regardless of the issue, whether it's work or something else.
Right. If you're having a meeting with management, management says something crazy, look at who everyone kind of turns to see what their reaction to that is. Yes?
Kind of like that, there is someone that can put forth ideas but is also good at communication.
Yes. It can be who trains new employees? Who's brought a lot of workers there? Who's been there for a long time? You know, who has respect on the job? Who organizes the social functions, right? Who organizes the baby showers? So if someone's name keeps coming up when you're looking at questions like this, the chances are they're a natural leader. Number 8, assemble a team. Organizing and winning really requires you bring along others. I call it building your posse. You might not like the law enforcement reference, so you can call it whatever you like. But it could be when you're called in the boss's office to discuss a grievance or a settlement to a grievance issue or a discipline, who's going to be your witness to that conversation or to the grievance settlement? When you first start out, it might just be having one or two people you can say, hey, can you come to the boss's office with me and witness this conversation? Try to make it a practice to never meet with management alone. It's for your own protection. Literally, can be for your protection. Lori Beth tried to give the fire chief in San Francisco a copy of our union newsletter. This is a big, burly firefighter guy. It was about two of our coworkers who had dropped dead off the job. We knew it had to do, with the stress on the job. He refused to take it. She got into an argument with him about why he would not take a newsletter that talked about two of his employees who had died. He then turns around and says that Lori Beth physically intimidated him, that Lori Beth backed him into a corner, he feared for his physical safety, and they were going to terminate Lori Beth. It took a six-month camp, and there was no witnesses to that conversation. So it took 6 months to make that charge go away. If you don't have a posse or a group of folks you can call upon, you're going to be functioning as a superhero. And what do evil villains do to superheroes? Well, in TV and the movies, the superhero always prevails, but in real life, they often get taken out. If you're a superhero, it means you haven't built political relationships with your coworkers, it makes you a bigger target for management, it's going to add additional stress to your life, and it can quickly lead to burnout. Remember what we always tell our coworkers: the boss doesn't need you, but the boss needs all of you. So 9, leadership involvement and the concentric circle. Do you have my little...
Right behind you.
Oh, it got posted. Okay. This is my high-tech visual. So we often think of leadership and involvement as this linear continuum. Someone starts out as apathetic and uninvolved. Gradually, they get more active over time. They become an activist. We recruit them to be a steward. They then come to an ISO meeting or a DSA meeting or a solidarity meeting. A better way to think about involvement is this concentric circle model. So at the core are people that are always thinking about organizing and getting more people involved. It could be a steward, it could be someone in the union, or it could very well not be. In the first ring are your activists. These are the folks that can be counted on to help when there's a contract fight or a campaign. They'll get the word out, they'll recruit others to take part. In your second ring are your supporters. These are the folks that will come to meeting, they'll wear stickers, they'll sign a petition, they'll come to a rally, but they don't take responsibility for bringing anybody else with them. The third ring are people who seem disengaged. They may not see the union or the issue that you're organizing around as relevant for them, so they don't participate. And the outer folks, I should have drew them out here, are not people who just disengage, they're actually hostile. They are outside of that circle. Now the beauty of this model is that it lets you see your goals not moving people from the disengaged all the way to the core in one fell swoop in one campaign. What you're trying to do is you're moving people from one ring to the next. You're moving people from disengaged to being a supporter. You're moving supporters to activists and activists to the core. Number 10, find a role for everybody. This concentric circle model of thinking about involvement and activity helps make this point. The mark of a good socialist organizer is you can find a role for everyone. Not everyone wants to be as active as you, or even as active as most union activists are. But there is something that everyone can and would be willing to do. Your job is to find out what that is. That person might not want to be out front, they may not want to attend meetings, but they could post something on the bulletin board. They can take 10 flyers to their work area and pass them out. Maybe they like working on the newsletter or the website. Maybe they like organizing the social events. I get people to decorate the union bulletin board, you know, so it attracts people's attention, but there is a role for everybody. 11, one-on-one conversations. As a socialist at work, you're going to be doing a lot of advocating, a lot of promoting, motivating, explaining, and debating. Sometimes it's easy to forget that one of the most important skills that we need is the ability to listen. 70% of a good organizing conversation is about listening. The cliche, we've got 2 ears and 1 mouth, should give you an idea of the ratio of listening to speaking. It's a skill that many good union organizers, socialist organizers, if you sell a socialist worker, you probably already honed this skill. But listening doesn't mean simply waiting to talk. Building political relationships requires that we understand our coworkers' views, what they're based on, and why they resonate with them. There are a lot of elements to good organizing conversation. I know folks have your own sort of organizing conversation. Folks can share that if they want. 12, building unity. Solidarity can arise spontaneously in a natural disaster like we saw at Hurricane Katrina, but it can also be consciously built. Racism, sexism, homophobia, and other divisions in the class are not overcome automatically through struggle. Struggle opens up people to new ideas and new ways of thinking, but unity has to be built consciously through deliberate acts of solidarity. Workers in your workplace are going to be divided in a myriad of ways. You need to find out what those are. Is it classifications, occupations, high pay, low pay, white collar, blue collar, work assignments, shift assignments, language, immigrant versus native born, politics. And you'll find that pay and benefits are often follow race, sex, and gender lines. Worksite organizational power is only going to be as strong as your ability to reach across these divisions and build unity. 13, someone brought this up at the Organized and the Unorganized last night. Aim your fire at management. This is an important strategy developed by the Socialist Workers Party and their work with Teamsters in Milwaukee. So many of our union officials are distant, ignorant, lack of courage or conviction, some places are corrupt. This has to do with their mediating role between the employer and their rank and file. It makes them vacillating with a knee-jerk reaction to shut down militancy. Socialists can sometimes get fixated on attacking union officials while ignoring the real problem, which is the employers. The Milwaukee Socialists made it a point, always aim your fire at management. If the union officials want to step into that line of fire to protect or defend management, the workers will see them doing that. So 14, building political relationships. Whether it's building collective power at our work site, building trade union organization, building a labor left, or building a socialist organization, at their root, they all involve building political relationships with coworkers. You can and build other types of relationships, but the political relationships are the ones that we care about here. Socialist worker, one of the best tools for building these relationships is socialist worker. It's a conversation starter. Socialist worker, as everyone here knows, runs a gamut from trade union struggles to social movements to ideas of socialist ideas and history of class struggles. You might not be aware, but socialist worker comes with a guarantee. It's on the inside cover. You probably haven't seen it. It says, guaranteed to start a debate with your coworkers. I have some white-collar workers that are educated, you know, with their bachelor's and master's, and they don't like socialist worker. They want something that goes more into depth, that has references, that develops an argument, so I make them buy the ISR. So, 16. It's a long-term battle. Class war is a battle of position. We're building for the long term, and despite your best organizing, you may not see immediate results. But you could very well be having an impact in setting things in motion. Management often doesn't capitulate overnight in one fell swoop. Paramedics in San Francisco, we'd had it with our medical director. He was a mouthpiece for whatever management worked. He allowed us to be put on 24-hour shifts. He descaled the ambulances from two paramedics to one paramedic. He was indirectly responsible for the death of a dear coworker of ours. We held a vote of no confidence in him. Two-thirds of the paramedics voted they had no confidence in our medical director. He was still there the next day, but we had set in motion a process that made it impossible for him to continue to be the medical director when he knew that two-thirds, and the whole city knew that two-thirds of the paramedics had no confidence in him. I literally just won a huge class action grievance for our temporary athlete workers. It was a fight that we started in 2011. It involved scores of people, months of field work, research, campaigning, pressure tactics. 2 years ago, we won a settlement where we converted a temporary part-time jobs, about 500, into permanent benefited jobs. Just 2 weeks ago, we won the back pay damages portion, $1.4 million. I think it's the biggest settlement I've been involved in. But I could give you lots of other examples of campaigns that have taken months or years. Just because you lose the first round, and you lose the second round, and you lose the third round, don't give up. If you keep at it, if you keep finding ways to raise it, if you keep applying pressure, if you keep building the campaign and fighting on multiple fronts, you might find a way to victory. 17, the last one I'm going to end on this one, is about collective action. The heart of socialist labor work revolves around the idea of collective action. Our role is to turn issues into campaigns. Collective action builds the confidence, builds self-activity and solidarity, and can increase class consciousness. A socialist trade unionist learns how to identify the issues that affect the most people the most profoundly. When you find them, you want to involve as many folks as possible. You don't want to be the superhero doing it for the members. That doesn't build our power as workers. It doesn't build the knowledge and skills of your co-workers. Unions are about using the collective power of members to match the power of the employers. And that requires that we have to maximize participation and solidarity. My advice is start small. Pick an easy campaign to begin with. Maybe it's just getting people to wear stickers and badges, a unity break, wear your union colors, whatever it is, involve more people as you go along. Good group tactics are group grievances. If you're not in a union, a petition. People are reluctant to sign on. What I tell my coworkers, I'm not turning this grievance in until 25 of you sign. So they're confident that they'll be there with 25 other people, and they fill up quickly. Our nurses use a circular wheel for their group grievances, where people sign around in a circle, so no one is the first person to sign. Or you take five people in with you to present a grievance. Or I go out and I find 20 witnesses to the grievance, so I bring them in. You can always find a way to involve more people. You gotta be creative, you gotta make it fun for folks. We've had great actions on Valentine's Day where we get some coworkers to dress up as Cupids with little bows and arrows, and we went after the tech companies for not paying their taxes. We've dressed up as Robin Hoods, we've dressed up as capitalists like the Monopoly man, and we hand out notes to commuters thanking them for the tax cut that San Francisco gave them so they could buy their new yacht. In San Francisco, we found out the mayor had something called Tech Tuesday. Every Tuesday, he would go to a tech company in the city and say, "What can I as the mayor do to keep you in San Francisco?" We were appalled. Most of us had never seen him at our work site. So we launched what we called Worker Wednesday. And we invited the mayor to come to one of our work sites every Wednesday and address what he could do to keep workers in San Francisco. Yeah. We knew he wouldn't come, so we created a 7-foot-tall cutout of the mayor. We brought him to work sites, we set up a podium and a microphone, and workers got to come up and ask him questions. And you know what his answer was, right? Nothing. So our members loved it, and the media loved it. So in conclusion, our work in rebuilding unions and really our success as militants on the shop floor and in our union requires that we build political relationships with our coworkers, with other members in your union. We're surrounded by coworkers, and we should be engaging in conversation, building political relationships, developing common work, promoting collective struggles, and extending and defending our trade unions. We also have to be part of building a vibrant labor left. A labor left is going to require us to work with other forces, have debates, collaborate, and also occasionally fight with each other. And as we build our collective power at the places we work and rebuild our unions and contribute to a labor left, we also have to be building a strong socialist organization. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.